Okay, folks, let's start. Thanks for turning up Friday afternoon. If you remember, I was talking, taking you through some of the kind of major bits of punctuation for informatics, pretty much pre-20th century, actually, and pointing out some of the things that turned up that had an impact on the things that you're now learning. And then I got to this particular slide, which was the break before we come to that kind of a major bit of punctuation in the 20th century. Before I do that, I want to say a little bit about how things will go for the rest of the course, because we've got really 2 weeks left to go. On Thursday, we have the... I'm head of school. I have to do this. We're tied up with the graduations. We have our graduations on Thursday, so I won't be able to give the Thursday lecture. So we'll have to miss that one. So the last one, and I have another one in this bunch of lectures where I want to talk a little bit about the way things are, right up to the minute here. But I'll do that on Friday of next week. Thursday of next week, I can't make it. I'm doing the graduations, and then we have the week after. We have two lectures. And I'll use that to come back to the material that we've been talking about and make sure that everything's completely okay for, because you'll be thinking, by that time you'll be thinking about the exams, and so I just want to make sure you're completely comfortable for that. So that's how it's going to play. So this is the last one of the pair of lectures where we're talking about kind of major events in informatics. And here's the interesting thing that happened. I guess most of you all heard of one person in computer science. You probably heard of Alan Turing, I suppose. I'm not going to ask who hasn't heard of Alan Turing, because now if I asked, you'd be too embarrassed to say no. Okay, he did various things, actually, and lots of things that I'm not going to talk about now, of course. But one of the things he did was to come up with a concept that bears his name, which is the Turing machine. And here's, I think this is the pivotal. The pivotal paragraph, depending on who you are in computer science, if you ask somebody what's the kind of E equals MC squared moment for computer science, often they'll come up with this one. Isn't necessarily the only answer you get, but it's one answer. Basically, this is the bit where somebody steps up and says, well, we could just kind of have a universal machine that we give instructions to, and it could become any machine we want. That's really what he's saying. At least that's the way we understand it now today. It's what makes computers so interesting is devices, really. If you can have a generic machine that's just going to take a bunch of instructions in some language, and it's going to turn magically into any machine that you particularly want it to be. Of course, the physical limitations of the device and the interfaces and the languages that are on it are going to constrain the kinds of machine it will make. But that's really what it is, and that's really a very interesting idea to have. Right? So you can just some machine, and what's really also very surprising is how much the kind of generic notion of a Turing machine has persisted in theoretical computer science. Maybe not in the engineering of applications, where you're quite a long distance away from that kind of abstraction. It still has persisted. It was the kind of purest notion of machine that anybody could have had at that time. And there's no time to go into any depth into descriptions of Turing machines here, but I mean, for people who haven't come across it, here's the kind of basic idea. It's quite a simple one. The reason why I'm spending a little bit of time on it here is because it links into the finite state machine stuff that you've done. The sort of stuff you're doing with finite state machines is simpler than the stuff that people would do with the various varieties of Turing machine that people talk about who are interested specifically in this kind of thing. It's not so far away. So here's the idea of a Turing machine. You basically have an infinite tape that can rumble away through, and on the tape you can write zeros and ones. And you have a head that can read from the tape wherever it is. So if there's a particular point in the tape, it can read it. And then it can write to the tape or it can move the tape. So you have a big long sequence with a language of zeros and ones that you can operate on, simplest language you can imagine, and then you have something that can move around. And in some way, that's where you start with the Turing machine. And inside the head, there's an action table. And what that action table does is it tells the head what to do given the current state, and then it can set the new state. So it's a state-based system. And you can describe what that thing does with a finite state machine if you want. Okay, that's one way you can describe it. There's different ways you can describe it, and that gives you different variants on what the Turing machine is. Actually, there are different variants on the actual architecture of that Turing machine. I'm giving you the standard simple one. So here's an example of a little finite state machine. I don't want to dwell on it because that's going to take too long and I won't be able to talk about other things then. But imagine you could say, okay, what's this head going to do? Okay, well, it can be in four different states, including one where it halts. You're interested in whether your Turing machine will halt at some point. And then you can describe it as a normal kind of transducer machine with some halting states, right? You know how to do this. You've done it before for other things. So here's one where this one says is it starts in this state here, and then if it spots a zero, it prints a one on the head, and it moves to the right. That's the output from your finite state machine to the head of the Turing machine. And then it goes to this state. And then if it hits a zero, it prints again, and then goes back to the left. Or if it hit a one, it prints again and goes to the right. So this thing is going to move around, printing lots of ones on your tape and moving back over and trying to explore. And it eventually halts if it hits a one that it hadn't expected, if you see what I mean. So there's lots of different. This is just an example. It doesn't really matter that you understand this particular thing. The important thing to understand is you could have described the behavior of that thing using the sort of techniques that you had learned. But the most important thing, and the most important when you go back to that thing, which I said was that was the E=mc² moment, isn't so much that you could build a machine like that, but it's that you could pass into that machine instructions on the tape that would tell it which machine to be. And that's the crucial thing. That's the bit where you're passing in and you're expressing as data for the machine what it is what that machine is then going to be, what it's going to turn into. And that's what distinguishes computers from lots of other devices. That's why the calculus rationator that Leibniz was doing so many centuries before wasn't really a computer, but this really is. Right. So stepping around as usual, I must admit this, when I was doing these slides, I really was starting to get stuck. It's really quite difficult to know who it is that you're going to put up on the slides, because once you hit the 20th century, once Alan Turing has done his thing and said you can build machines like this, and yeah, it takes a wee while for that to kind of blossom out. And it wasn't just him, of course. There's various other forces that are pushing in various directions. But suddenly it goes boof, and there's lots of people doing lots of things. So it becomes very, very difficult to be selective. So if anybody who actually, some other person in a similar kind of line of work as me, looking at this lecture, would probably go, oh, he should have chosen that person or some other person. Yes, of course, that's true. This is now very, very subjective. I'm just choosing some examples. So one example I would choose, because I spent quite a lot of time you probably don't know, but before there was informatics, there were other departments in Edinburgh. I'll maybe mention this at some point later. One of them was the artificial intelligence department, where I used to be. This guy up here, John McCarthy, was one of the people who was very instrumental in building up that kind of effort, and has had quite a big impact in informatics. So that particular term, it's been a term of some controversy, because that was the idea was, well, let's try as hard as we can, let's try and build something that would approximate a human doing all the things that humans do. That's kind of the ultimate goal of artificial intelligence. So it's just a nice neat phrase encapsulating that. Of course, never been achieved. Nobody ever knows whether you'll be able to do that in the strong sense, but you can have quite a lot of fun trying. So one of the other things that he did was much more practical, which I put on the slide here because it links into your Haskell stuff, is he invented a language called Lisp, which was one of the early functional programming languages. So it used to be in the early days of AI, there used to be big arguments about whether you would use Lisp or you would use Prolog. And that's a bit like the sort of argument you might have nowadays if you're talking about whether you would use, actually still one, Prolog, or one of the other logic programming languages, or you would use Haskell or something like that. And those arguments never end because there is no good answer to that question. It depends on what you're good at and what the problem is. So the thing about, it wasn't just John McCarthy that really got artificial intelligence going. Actually, quite a lot of it was going here for reasons I'll explain. But that actually led to lots and lots of different things. I'm going to explain to you a couple of things. I can't explain to you all of them, but I thought I'd just choose two that seem to be very relevant. And the first one of those, I want to mention another guy called Donald Mickey, who used to be here. I like this example. I just can't help it. I like this example. Machine learning. I don't know how easy it is to find the paper now, but I remember when I was starting off doing stuff. This is going back a wee bit. I'm sorry. I'm getting quite old now. But 25 years ago, when I was really starting off with this, then looking at some of the then was kind of slightly older papers, and one of them was doing machine learning using matchboxes. I thought it was just great. You get a bunch of matchboxes, and you can turn it into a system that learns how to beat somebody at tic-tac-toe, noughts and crosses, right? So a simple little game. Be trivial to code up something that could, you know, beat at least beat or at least draw with somebody at tic-tac-toe, because it's that kind of game. But to do it out of matchboxes, I thought was quite nice. And you have to remember, these things were being done at the time when there wasn't an awful lot of computing equipment to play with. So those were the mechanisms that people had. I think you can still find the paper. It's great. But people like this, not just Donald, actually, who set up the machine intelligence perception department here and did various other things with his life. That led to really, you know, an awful lot of the stuff that people now do with machine learning. I mentioned some of that in the last slide. I was talking about the probabilistic stuff that people do, which is probably the dominant paradigm now, I suppose. But another paradigm is the symbolic machine learning, which Donald was more involved in. I thought I'd just give you an example of that sort of thing, because this enables me to link back to the axiomatic logic stuff that we'd been doing. So here's an example of one of the earliest forms of computational rather than matchbox type machine learning. So this is about the simplest thing that you could think of in that area. It's a thing called a decision tree. So the problem it's trying to solve is this one. So suppose you have a big database, so you have a big table of these are some kind of fruit, something like that. Okay, I'm making up this example. And then you have a whole lot of examples of whether they're safe or dangerous. Is it going to kill you when you eat it? And you have a lot of examples. And so you know this one is safe. It's got hairy skin, it's brown, it's large, and it's got hard flesh, right? And you do a lot of them. You have a lot of examples. Okay, you could write each one of those examples then, if you want to, as an axiom in logic. So if you wanted to, then you could do this. So you would say, take the first one. I'd say, let's see, skin, hairy, and color, brown, and size, large, and flesh, hard. Implies safe, or if I wanted to, toxicity safe or something, right? So there you go. There's an axiom that I've written for you in predicate logic, so not far, so far away from your propositional logic. And I could, if I want, write one for every one of these rows in the table, and then I'd have a big set of axioms. That'd be a useful thing to have, I suppose, because then if somebody came along and gave me some of these, I could say, it's safe. Congratulations, you could eat it. I could say, I could build a system that did that. That wouldn't be so hard, right? Or I could just look up the database. That would be equivalent. And it would tell me that. That's good. But the trouble is, that isn't going to give me, suppose I get one that's not quite like that. So I don't know. It's hairy and red and small, and I don't know what the flesh is, or something like that. I don't know, maybe I've got one in there, but one that's not one of the examples that I've studied. What's my system going to say then? Nothing. But that's not very helpful, because I've got something I want to either eat or not. I want to know want to have some, at least I want to get some kind of indication. I'd also quite like if I didn't have to have quite so many examples, right? I'd like to build it smaller so that it was more compact and more portable. So that would be good, right? To do that, we need something that's going to do. Remember, I was talking in a previous lecture about difference between deduction and induction, right? So I'd like something that does that kind of, an induction is kind of a generalization, right? I want something that generally covers the sort of thing that I'm seeing. Okay, so I want to do that. Decision trees do that for you. So here's a simple decision tree algorithm. This is the world's simplest machine symbolic machine learning algorithm. Yeah, you've seen one of the world's simplest probabilistic algorithms and hidden Markov models. Now you'll see one for symbolic machine learning. All you do is choose one of these attributes, and I'll just choose color, right? Color can be brown or green or red, and then you go and look and say if they're brown, what does that discriminate between it being safe or dangerous? Actually, it does in this database. So if anything that's brown turns out to be safe. Okay, and so then I don't need to worry about anything else connected to being brown. I stop. If it's green, not so good, because there are green things that are both safe and dangerous, so I need to go further. So green, okay, and then I choose another one that's not color. I choose size. Turns out if it's large, it's safe. If it's large and green, it's safe. If it's small and green, it's dangerous. So that discriminates. Nothing falls in between. Yep. Green. Oh, bugger. Oh.
The forefront button also mismatches. It's red and hairy, but also dangerous.
Red. Oh, no, that's okay, because the red, I'm going to go down here. Red is okay, but I'm wrong here. I must have got this one wrong. I shouldn't have this one.
Then you're going to continue down the red and
Well, let's see. If it's red and hairy, is that is there a dangerous one?
Yeah.
Red. Red and hair. Oh, it's a bit more complicated than I've got then. Okay, so the examples are a little skewed. I'm sorry, I was doing this in a hurry. But you get the idea, right?
Yeah.
Right? So if this had been true, then I would end up with something that looked like this. And the important point is then what I can do is I can look through here and I can derive my rules. So my rule here is color brown implies safe, right? Which is shorter than these ones, right? And then I have another 6 rules. And I have a much more compact rule base than I would have here. And the other nice thing about that rule base is that if I come across with something else that is brown and has some other attributes, it's brown and it's whatever is not here. Brown and large and soft or something, then that'll still say it's going to be safe, which is good and bad, because I haven't seen any of those examples, so it could be that another one comes along, a bit like me making a mistake in the database here, and you go, it's not like that, and then I need to extend this thing down. But still, it's going to do the best that it can with the information it's got and do the generalization for you. And that's more or less, I mean, this is the simplest example that I could possibly give you for symbolic machine learning. But more or less, that's the deal. And the sort of problems that you get with that, even with a simple one, are the normal problems that you get. So all of this is being artificially constructed. I was just choosing a particular attribute and saying, oh, we'll choose color. That'll be a good one. I could have chosen one of these ones, like size at the start, and that particular tree would have been completely different. Right? You can do it yourself and see what happens. So all these things are all of these things are automatic, but they're very sensitive to the choices that you automatically make. So huge amounts of effort then go into building these sorts of systems, and lots of systems that contain these kinds of methods. Okay, the second one I wanted to do on AI, I couldn't resist putting this one in. Somebody else giving a talk here was using this example not that long ago as well. So now back in 1739, people were talking about robots as well. That's true. So I'm going to talk a little bit about robotics. The reason I've thrown in robotics here is because it allows me to link back to the state machine type stuff that you've been doing. So that's the reason why I'm featuring that here, rather than some other AI thing. Same reason as why when I was giving the machine learning stuff, it was to link back to your stuff on propositional logic. So So then the question is, what's the difference between that and the sort of stuff that people do more in a more modern way for robotics? And the difference is that really this is just an assembly of mechanical parts that looks like a duck from the outside, but inside it's just an assembly of clockwork parts. There's no attempt to really have a nice control system or anything like that. I mean, this is really just a joke. I mean, it's just somebody drew a picture. But one of the architectures that people, that actually this is Rod Brooks. I didn't put up a special slide for Rodney Brooks, but it's his architecture I'm thinking, or him and the people who are working on this kind of thing that I'm thinking of. A thing called the subsumption architecture, which is a way, I think the easiest way to explain it to you folk is it's a way of thinking about finite state machines that allows you to build architectures for systems where they're interacting very closely with the environment. So the way I've described a lot of the stuff about finite state machines so far has been, whether it wasn't maybe very overt, but all of it has really been thinking about building things kind of top down, and you have your specification that you specify as a finite state machine, and then you kind of refine it. You build systems that are consistent with that, and all the way down you build your system. One of the things that held up a lot of robotics work early on was trying to build systems that way. It's quite hard to build robotic systems that way. Some you can, because you have a very tightly constrained behavior that you want to, a robot arm in a factory maybe, because you know the environment is as constrained as you can possibly make it. The cars or whatever it is that it's going to weld will be in exactly that position. There's various means that you can use to make sure that it's super accurate. And what your robot is really doing is just repeating a lot of tasks using a fairly rigid control system. But that's not really what robotics people want to do. What robotics people really want to do is to build robots that would, you know, walk down the stairs and come in and give the lecture that I'm giving, and maybe better than I would, because they would be better fed with data and so on and so forth. That's what they'd really like to do, have robots work in complicated environments where there were humans present and all this sort of stuff. Maybe other robots present and they would interact with them. So it's hard then to build that top down, because the environment is continually changing underneath you, and it's not like you have a fixed set of requirements at the beginning that you can work with. Not really, not very precise anyway. And so then a lot of robotics people took the other track and said, okay, let's just make the most we can of the environment, and we'll have to have design methods that help us just adapt the way we build the robot depending on the environment into which we are going to put the damn thing. And that's what subsumption architectures try to do. So the basic idea of a subsumption architecture is to keep it nice and simple, build individual behaviors, and then build up the system on the behaviors that you start building up at the low level. It becomes a bit more clear later. So basic thing is you have a finite state machine. It's got input wires. It's got output wires. And that finite state machine describes a particular bit of behavior of the system. And you build behaviors hierarchically. And the more behaviors you build, the more sophisticated the abilities of your robot is the idea. So modular, but by behavior. Okay, and there's some timing stuff that I'm going to talk about. And then, so those are your finite state machines. Then you have wires that link up the finite state machines. They're not quite the finite state machines that I was talking about, but I'm just going to finesse that just so that we don't get bogged down. And the wires send messages between the state machines. And because it's a robot, one of the things I always think is lovely about robotics, which is not true for the stuff I work on, is every robot you build is kind of individual, because there's so much hardware involved. And when you say move the robot arm from here, from position whatever it is to position whatever it is, it hasn't, because it's a physical arm, and there's all sorts of things that are special about just the way it was built. So people get attached to their robots, actually, in robotics for that reason, in a way that you can't get attached to software, because software isn't like that. Well, some software is, but not all. Anyway, so then when you have that problem, you have to allow for faulty wiring. So there could be all sorts of things that go wrong with the wiring, because it's a real robot and it's in a physical situation. Okay, so then here are the nodes that you have in connecting things. So you have inhibition nodes. So an inhibition node, you have a wire, and then you have nodes that influence what goes on through the wires going into your finite state machines determining the behavior. So the detail of this doesn't really matter. I just wanted to show you that there weren't that many of them. So you have inhibition thing where this thing is sending a message in and it interrupts the message going across. So you can say inhibit that bit of the system. This is one that suppresses it. just briefly replaces it. So this one comes in, this some message going along here, channeling along through, and this says, okay, put in this one now, and through it goes. Or you can default it, okay? And here's the design method. So and this is a lot different from the one that I, the kind of standard top-down style of design. So what you do, you're building your robot. You first start, think, what's the basic thing it needs? Maybe it has to be able to move a leg or something or whatever. You lift a leg or move an arm or something like that. And so you build a system that will do that with your finite state machines and your wires and your connectors, right? Which probably, I mean, you're not so far off from being able to do that if you turn your minds to it and you had the right components. Then you build a layer of state machines at that level for that competence. So probably your robot doesn't do much, but what it does, you kind of know it works in the environment. And then you test it until you think that bit works well, and then you freeze that layer. You're not going to change it at all now. And then you think of the next most sophisticated thing that you do, and then you just keep building, having frozen the layers below. So it's a funny kind of incremental design. Here's one, Genesis, a tiny little picture of it there. Here's a schematic of it. It was a six-legged robot. And the way it worked was, and it just kind of walked along. And then, so you've got the kind of A motion, swinging legs like that, B motion, swinging them up. It has a couple of feelers at the front so it can detect things and so on. Quite a lot of robots like this nowadays. This is a simplification of the sort of control system. The only reason I'm putting this in is just to give you an idea of the type of thing. It doesn't really matter that you understand this, of course. So here are the different levels. So you think of one level of competence. Important that Genesis can stand. Oof. So make sure that it can stand up. That's the first thing, most basic thing they can do. If it can do that, let's try and make it walk. That's level two, at level one here. And then you get, so it can walk on a flat surface. And then you think, okay, maybe now we can start building up more behaviors. Can it walk over terrain of different kinds? And then you start building more things like foraging and so on that require more things. And as you build these things, then you have different parts of the system that are allocated to it. So to stand, it has to be able to apply force and balance and change the position like this. Right? That's the minimum that needs to stand. So you would be building that bit first. Right? Then once it can do that, then you want it to be able to walk. So the leg has to be able to go up, down, forward, balance. Okay. And that has to link into these things. Once it can do that, then you have to be able to have things that will help it spot whether it's going to collide. Once it can do that, then you can start to build in all these other more sophisticated things, steering it around or being able to prowl around in different ways. You have information from the feelers and so on. So you kind of see how it builds, right? And that's the basic way that these guys work. Okay, I just wanted to mention, I'm not going to dwell on this, so I just wanted to throw in this slide. There's lots that could be said about databases, of course, and databases is one of the things that has really dominated the industry in some respects. And I'm just going to have one slide on it, just a nod to the relational database model. All I want to say is you've seen it, right? So remember very early, about the second lecture or something, one of the examples was doing database join. Where did that come from? People like Edgar Codd defining the basic theory of databases, talking about tables. A row in a table, that table is a tuple. You have attributes in the table and you have relations. Actually, one of the previous slides where we were talking about machine learning, we did exactly that, and you've already seen it. Where it started was there. Okay. Now on to something different. I put this one in. Could have used lots of other people, but I just wanted to use it for the quote. It allows me to make a point. I couldn't resist it. The intergalactic computer network. I like the sound of that. So it sounds so ridiculous actually now, but actually we owe a lot to this. This is going back 1963. Here's the quote I've got. I assume it's accurate. In 1963, I was exactly 1 year old, so I have no idea really. But so it's kind of nice quote. So you have to remember, this is before we were so accustomed to doing so many things with networking. And people were thinking at this scale, I mean, 6 or 8 computers working together was just huge. This guy was really, really speculating. And the interesting thing is, this became the ARPANET, and then the ARPANET eventually evolved in various ways into the internet. So this sort of thinking was indeed what led to the internet, and all sorts of other steps along the way. So another thing that led to the internet, and here's so that isn't a link back to the stuff you've done, but this is. So another thing that they really needed for the internet was TCP and the Internet Protocol. It's very fine to have the sort of it's very fine to join everything together with wires, but you have to have some way of everything talking to each other. So without things like TCP, IP, and then all the other things that are built on the stack on top of that. So when you communicate on the internet, in fact, you're using a stack of things, and one crucial part of the stack is TCP, IP, which is making sure that the messages that you're passing around in the internet are reliably sent and received. Somebody has to invent that, and here are a couple of the guys who did that, Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn. When you look at protocols like that, here's an example. I just copied this across. Not very important for you to understand this, but it is important for you to understand that the sort of things that you're doing, describing things. This hits two buttons as far as the course we've been doing is concerned. It hits obviously the state machine button, because this really is just a big state diagram. It's not the same sort of state diagram that you've been using. It's a little bit more subtle in its notation. It's really a bit more like a picture than a proper state diagram. It's losing quite a lot of detail if we were to use it for real for reasoning about TCP. It's the way that people think about protocols like this. The other way that people think about protocols like this, and I haven't got a diagram for you, is of course as a piece of logic. So if you can draw this as a state machine, you could also draw this as a bunch of process definitions. Okay, just like the rules that we had in the logic course where we were talking about the temporal change bit. Okay. So the sort of thing that you've been learning there links into stuff like this. Now for something slightly different again. I'm jumping around a bit. I wasn't really sure what to include here. The person I've used is Alan Robinson, because it links in quite closely to what we've been doing on the logic side. Because remember resolution? We talked about resolution, right? You have this method, which is a single proof rule for being able to do all of these fancy proofs. The guy who invented that was Alan Robinson. Lots of other people have developed things connected to that. The person I most commonly would think about is Bob Kowalski, various people can claim to have invented logic program actually in different ways. It wasn't a simple thing. Inventing languages isn't really a simple thing, because quite often what happens is somebody invents the basic theory of, say, resolution like Alan Robinson, and someone else will take that and understand that at maybe the specification level that, like Bob Kowalski, Kolmogorov did way back, and other people will build implementations for compilers or interpreters and so on from the languages, like David Warren, for example. In fact, the first proper logic program compiler, I believe, was built by David Warren here. So it's quite complicated, but certainly those guys were there. And the interesting, so then I was thinking, what's the important thing to tell you about that, actually, from an engineering point of view? And I think the most important thing isn't so much the language, although that, of course that's important, there's a whole family of languages just like in functional programming. But I think the interesting thing is the idea of an executable specification, which I haven't really talked about before, and I think it's nice for you to know. I've given you a slide on that. Don't know if this is the best way to explain it, but we'll see how it goes. So there's different kinds of specification that you can use logic for. And there are at least three, maybe more if you wanted to get fancy about it, but there's certainly at least three. One is what I've called a non-executable specification, a specification for where, if you look at the specification, you really don't know how to build anything executable from it. It takes more work to think about it. So here's a nice one. If I want to specify, say, square root in terms of squared, right? Here's a lovely specification of it. That's just lovely, right? So if I want to, if somebody says to me, can you define, I know what squared means. I know it means to square a number. But can you tell me what it means to take the square root of a number? That's a perfect answer. So you say, OK, x is the square root of x squared. But if somebody says, OK, that's very precise. Now I know exactly what that means. Build me something that does that, that computes it. That doesn't compute it directly, right? That's not something that you're going to compute from, although it does precisely specify it. And this is sort of, so it's in some ways, that's a, either I could actually see, I could see the reaction here. Some people go, ooh. And other people go, what? Well, that doesn't tell me very much. but actually, it is, the difference is pretty profound when you're actually practically doing things. Because both are useful. Right? That's the thing. So the one that's not executable can sometimes be very useful. It's just absolutely pinning down what the concept is. And I don't need to ever, I can write that down. I don't need to think about a machine. That one's correct. If no machine existed that would ever compute that, it's still precise in the way that I described, right? It's perfectly precise, even if there is never a machine that could execute it. So that's quite a useful thing. On the other hand, if I do want to build a machine that executes it, I need something more than that. So this one here is also a specification. This is a specification for merging two sets, if I got it right. I mean, maybe somebody will spot an error here, but I think I got it right. So let me explain what this thing does. So this set, merge is true if you can take two sets, S1 and S2, and merge them to get a third set which has all the elements of both, right? You have two sets, and you merge them. So if S1 is a set containing whatever you like, A and B, and S2 is a set containing B and C, then SM would be ABC. Not necessarily in that order. And here's a precise definition of it. This one says if S1 is empty, this is going to be true if S1 is empty and SM equals S2. If I join an empty set to another set, it's just the same set that I get. And it would be true if I can remove some element from S1, leaving whatever's left, and it's not in S2, and I can merge SR with S2 to get some other set, and then I can add in X to S4 to get the final merged set. This is just a recursive definition, right? So I think unless I've missed something out there, that's right. It doesn't really matter whether I miss. Oh yes. Oh yes, maybe I was actually thinking as I was speaking that I must have missed something out, because there should be something other than this not. Oh, so there probably should be another or here that says remove X from S1 SR and X is in S2 and merge SR S2 S4 and S4 equals SM. That would be the third case. Yeah. So right. So the point is though that for this one it's still a specification, right? It's still logic. Right, I have to define what remove means. I have to define what add is, but that would just take me another couple of axioms. So that's still in the logical world, but I can execute that. That is a logic program, right? So I could just give that to an interpreter, and I will get a solution for that. Because I've put in a bit of time to make sure that I set it up in a way that it would be able to execute. Here's another one for merge. This is kind of nearly executable, I'd say. That's a kind of imprecise way of putting it, but let me explain to you what I mean. So this says I can merge set S1 with S2 to get SM. So I mean merge to be exactly the same as I meant before with the other specification. But this time I'm going to define it differently. It's nearly the same, but not what this says. If X is in S1 or X is in S2, then X is in SM. And S1 is a set and S2 is a set and SM is a set. That defines it too, right? Trouble is, it's not so readily executable. I could maybe have a system that would take that specification and reliably produce SM. I could just have a clever theorem prover that was able to construct SM, maybe. But it would take more work. So the point I'm trying to make is, there's a space now between things that are clearly not executable, because we can't really imagine any machine that's going to construct just from that specification of the program directly, to things that are completely executable, because I can just give it to an interpreter and run. The things that are kind of in between, if I had a smart enough interpreter or a smart enough theorem prover, they would run. And what logic programmers try to do is to make everything be here. What they want is everything that I could possibly write as a specification in some generic, fairly high-level specification language be executable. And that's really hard. No logic programming language I've ever seen is quite like that. You can get close. And why is that hard is the question, I suppose. The reason it's hard is because it's quite difficult to get something that's as high level as this, loses so much detail that it's very high level, but also has enough detail to tell the theorem prover that's going to actually do the proof for you what to do. That's the difficulty. There's also some issues about what you do with state if this thing is going to manipulate a real machine. Okay, so that's a kind of interesting tension that's always there when you're doing things with programming and formal languages. Okay, how are we doing for time? 5 minutes, okay. Oh, 5 minutes and I'm right at the end. So the last part, I couldn't not mention Tim Berners-Lee, I guess, since I'm talking about this. But there is a point to be made here as well. Everybody's heard of Tim Berners-Lee, right? Reason everybody's heard of Tim Berners-Lee is actually for quite a precise technical thing, actually, building the first web server and browser effectively. Okay, at least the makings of that, shall we say. The other thing that he's done that's been very, very effective subsequently is to find the World Wide Web Consortium, which helps to control all of this. And here's a nice quote from him that helps you. I mean, you may be becoming already familiar with a little bit. Some of you actually turned up to Henry Thompson's inaugural, I believe, and so Tim Berners-Lee was there if you were at that particular seminar. But I think this is quite nice because it kind of encapsulates a kind of modern view of what you do when you're building these types of systems. So what you're doing here isn't it's kind of worth reading through, actually. So the important point here is that it's more a kind of social activity than it's a technical activity. So you build a simple technical thing. I'm sure even if Tim Berners-Lee was here, he would say actually the technical bit of that wasn't by itself, earth-shattering. It's not like somebody finding a fundamental theorem of the universe or something like that. It's a technical thing that actually is well-placed and it works, which is just fantastic. And it slightly unexpectedly works. Quite a lot of people in the computer science community didn't believe that sort of thing would work because there are lots of holes in how that kind of thing. There's what will you do when the links break and so on was a big concern for people thinking about it abstractly. But then socially it works. Socially, we don't care when a link breaks because there's plenty more links. And we're prepared to pay for the systems that will help make it easy to make the connections to the links and the pages and the systems that actually work. And that sort of thing snowballs for social reasons. And the reason it's so effective socially is because then it influences society itself and that changes. I'll talk a little bit more about those sort of things on the modern war recently. So this is something, it's got quite a lot of the words in it that are important. The fact that it's socially embedded, the fact that it relies on trust, and the fact that it changes the society in which it's built. And that's something that you don't see so much in people talking about work that came earlier than that. And I think it's a sign of how pervasive the sort of technology we use has become. So I'll leave you, we're just about on time. So I'll leave you with that thought. Then what's gonna happen is, don't turn up on Thursday, because I won't be here, you'll be all on your own. Turn up on Friday, and I'll have the conclusion of these kinds of lectures. Then the week after, we go through everything and make sure that you're happy with the technical material. See you on Friday.
You mean the slides or the video? But neither are in WebCT. So most of the slides for the lectures are on the link from the website, not from WebCT.
And what about these
extra ones? No, because I've been writing them. I wrote this one yesterday. they will appear though. I'll put them up.
Okay.
And the videos you find somewhere else.
Most of the time, and I think he's the expert. These are